Okay, I don't know where we left Noel Lyon, but I think we pretty well covered it.
Well, you mentioned that you were a Canadian nationalist, and because you had seen lots of the country, and constitutional law was a natural for poli sci. I think he had offered you a summer job.
Yeah, to help him write his textbook. I think I was a nationalist from the time I was an idealistic junior high student, too. I remember in 1958 or so being wrapped up in the Follow John movement for John Diefenbaker. When I started law school, I was a big fan of Tom Berger. I guess I'd known of Tom from... forget where I'd first known of him, but when he decided to go into politics and run for the leadership of the NDP, I'd been supporting the NDP. I come from an NDP CCF background, and Tom I had a lot of respect for. And I remember when my wife and I think in '68 were on a camping trip, staying in a motel one night to watch the election results, and were quite disappointed that Tom didn't get elected. And of all people, Dave Barrett, the next election, got elected. But so I've always been a great fan of Tom's. I've done battle with him in court since, but I'm still a great fan of his. So you were talking about politics that
you had talked about teaching at the law school and going back and getting your BA, and it'd be interesting to hear about your what kind of law you practiced and
I am reminded I should tell you a couple more things.
Sure.
About law school, but I'll go to answer your question first.
Well,
I started out in, and I stayed in civil litigation. We had good articling at Ladner Downs, and you're supposed to do a term in like four different rotations, but I asked if I could sort of skip some of the corporate or commercial and just stay in litigation, and they let me. And my career has been in courtroom litigation or administrative law. After practicing for a couple of years, I started administrative law work. The very first case I had was a professor in the medical faculty who was denied tenure. And my partner at the time, Peter Hyman, convinced him I was the tenure specialist. There weren't any tenure specialists, but I said to him, well, Peter must have meant is I've done some administrative law. And anyway, very hard to win a tenure case at UBC, but we won that one. And then I did that for another 10 or 15 years, but it was very frustrating. I finally told the faculty association that, you know, it was the good teachers who fought, and they really were mostly really good teachers, and very hard to win. And it was costing them a lot of money, and so they hired in-house counsel after that, and I didn't do any more. But my career has been litigation and administrative law, which is the same thing. When I taught trial advocacy at the university, I used to try and convince the students that it didn't matter what form you were in, the principles were the same. You had to be well prepared, understand your case, and put the witnesses forward that could help you or hurt the other side, if possible, and make the arguments. So whether you're in the Supreme Court of Canada or police court or in front of a real estate board disciplinary hearing, the advocacy principles are the same. I tried to pass on that kind of advice to a lot of young lawyers over time as well, and I'm sure sure some of them have received it well and learned from it. But my career is, you know, I have done some business kind of stuff, often for First Nation band councils. But that was, you know, if you fight over enough contracts, you learn how to draft a contract. But in simple terms, I've always been a litigator. I have sat as an arbitrator off and on over the last 10 years, and I encourage that kind of practice. Anyway, that's the answer to that question.
Mm-hmm. But you had some more law school anecdotes, you said.
Well, I was just thinking, going back to advice I followed and advice I passed on to other students about, one was how to do well on exams. And some people would listen to me, some people just couldn't accept what I was telling them. But my secret in doing well in law school and on exams was paying very close attention to the question and reading the question and rereading the question and then convincing myself I knew what the question was. And then I'd jot down roughly what the answer was, and then I'd write out the answer. And with remarkable success. It was years after law school, a classmate of mine, Brian Shapiro, reminded me that I used to frustrate the class sometimes. I wasn't a great brain or anything like that, but if you follow my formula, what more is there to say? You know, you double check your spelling and your writing. But I would sometimes, on a 2 or 3 hour exam, I'd be ready to leave after an hour. But I wasn't going to get the wrath of my fellow students, so I'd hang in there trying to figure out something to do for the next 15 minutes or so. Then finally I'd get up and leave to hisses and boos and catcalls. But it's a lesson I've tried to pass on to other people as far as law school, because I guess there's maybe some tricks in the questions, and some people might write eloquent answers, but it's the wrong question they're answering. So because we are talking about the law school, I just thought I should add that as something appropriate for law school. Now, law school's changed a lot since I was there, and I don't even know if they grade on standard grading anymore and that sort of thing. But that was one of the things I was reminded of when we had the break. But what the other one was, I've forgotten now.
Yeah. Well, I know that how important it is to read the question. I think I was tripped up once on that. You do tend to, if you're not careful, you get off onto some tangent and miss the point of the thing.
Yeah, or miss it entirely. Oh, I remember what the other thing was now. I don't want to give you the wrong impression. When I told you I went to classes, that was the easiest way for me to learn, because you can get things clarified. But I wasn't one of those guys who sat in the front row and asked questions just to be heard. As a matter of fact, I had, in first year particularly, a lot of butterflies in my stomach and a lot of hesitation before I'd ask a question. But I wanted to know, and if I was confused, I finally get the courage and ask the question. And to my relief, almost every time, the other students appreciated the question, because they might have been thinking the same as I was, but it takes a lot of courage to put your hand up and ask. And
were the professors ever rude? Did they ever shoot you down, or were they fair and recognized that as
they were
recognized good questions?
They were good. There was the odd first row type who would ask questions that he knew the answer to, and he was just being a pain in the ass, and that was unfair to the professor. And I don't recall the professors shooting them down, but certainly the rest of the class, you know, didn't appreciate that kind of showing off. But it's there again, it's a great way to it's a great way to learn, is to, you know, try and make sure you're confident, but do ask a question you don't understand, because it might clear up a lot of stuff. And the we did moots in law school. My first moot was judged by our first year moots were judged by three students, third year students, and Mike Harcourt, Keith Benson, and Jim Taylor were my three judges. And I remember asking my wife to come and watch, and nervous and all that, but the moot program changed, so I think Downtown Lawyers started being the judges for second and third year, I forget now, but that was a pretty exciting time. And yeah, just the learning process was pretty exciting at law school. I know some people say they didn't enjoy it, but it was, you know, it was enjoyable for me.
Who were some of your friends?
Well, I was in Section 2, which is funny. I don't know if you've heard about Section 2. You
no.
mentioned, you've interviewed Carrie Lind already.
I have, but I don't recall Section 2.
No, because Section 1 and 3, you see, they didn't have the camaraderie we had in Section 2. And I know that from, I didn't know him in law school, but Greg Bowden, who's now a judge, he became a very dear friend of mine from articles onward. He said we Section 2 people thought we had, you know, we thought we were special or something. Well, I think we were just the most irreverent. And we stuck together for at least the first 2 years. And I don't think they do that anymore in law school. I don't think they did that. So we had quite a number of characters in there, and they were from all types. And we didn't know much about the guys in Section 1 and Section 3. We had developed some good friendships with some of the teachers, like Scotty Poe. We developed disrespect for some of the teachers, like Mark Rutlinger. Mark was a bright young Harvard type or something, but he was okay, but he was a little self-important. He wanted us to sit according to a seat plan. Well, if you can imagine a Section 2 in 1967 sitting towards a seat plan. Those ideas quickly, I think he hollered at us one day, well, they do in Oxford or they do in some place. And everyone just sort of shrugged their shoulders. But we had, you know, a good friend of mine, Gordon Detweiler, was a great undergrad in English major. And another friend of mine, Ian Maxwell, they made a point of going to as few classes as they could. And they got, and they sort of were proud of just getting through each year. They both became great lawyers and excellent people. But they didn't have that keen to learn attitude. Or maybe they did it, but they disguised it well. Harry Boyle was a classmate. Harry always looked ancient, but in hindsight, even though he had a gray beard, he probably wasn't much older than the rest of us. But Harry had, I don't know if he'd be willing to be interviewed, but Harry's quite a character. He used to be a newspaper editor in the Yukon, and he became a judge after a while, too. He articled with Tom Berger. Don Brenner was a classmate, but he was in Section 2. But Don was probably didn't participate in, you know, there was different groups of friends in there. You know, Brian Abraham, Don Brenner, and Brian Webster were probably, you know, one group that I just knew casually or knew from the class, but I'm sure they bonded well. I think they practiced together at one time afterwards. Bill Seiger Gearson was a nice, semi-grizzled ex-fisherman from Prince Rupert. He was in the class. Section 2, well, not just Section 2, our law school class has done a pretty good job of having class reunions every 5 years. I took the lead basically on organizing those with much help from people, but basically it'd be my office that would I had, you know, as I said, I had Audrey for 26 years, and then I had Shelley for 10 years, and I, with a good secretary or legal assistant, it's easier to organize class reunions than it is if you have to do it on your own. But even though a lot of us didn't socialize that much with each other, we did a pretty good job of a lot of us getting together every 5 years. I'm sure I got many more notable people in my class than I just rattled off. But
what about the faculty? Did you mention one or two of them?
Well, the faculty was it was pretty good. We were in the old Army barracks. That was before the new law school. Now there's a newer law school, but. Bertie McLean was very popular. There was the odd guy from downtown that we didn't really see as downtown people, like Tom English, who taught tax. Peter Burns taught criminal. He was friendly to deal with. Dean Curtis was still teaching, although I don't think I had anything from him. What's the guy who taught jurisprudence? I think he became much more popular after my time than before my time. He seemed a bit stiff. Charles Bourne seemed a bit stiff. I think he loosened up over the years too. Maybe that transition period of the 67 to 70 and thereabouts softened some of these teachers from their earlier sternness. They were a pretty good lot, the faculty. Dean Curtis wasn't dean at the time. I think, I forget who took over. Was it Peter or Bertie McLean? Or they both became deans eventually. But Joost Blom was in my class. Joost wasn't section two, but he became dean as well. Good guy.
How did the sections work? Did they just divide the class into...
Yeah, it was just I don't know, it was probably a random selection to begin with, but you took, you know, if you were in section two, you were in section two for constitutional law, you were in section two for torts, you were in section two for contracts, and the same with one and three. I pretty certainly broke up that system after a while.
I've not heard of it.
Well, for instance, one of the cheeky things we did, and it was probably Brian Abraham or Webster or Brenner that there, we had gold medals, phony gold medals printed for everybody in section two when we graduated, which is not fair to section one and three, and it's kind of cheeky anyway.
There were, as you were talking, I jotted down a few questions that I was going to ask you. Well, this is going back a long way, but do you remember anything about Lord Denning's speech?
Well, my wife went with me, just because I asked her to. If you gave me, you know. It probably was something I was impressed with, but off the top of my head, I can't remember what he talked about. He's been to UBC more than one occasion, I think, but this was at the end of first year. And he gave after exams were over, it would have been Moscow. That's where I bumped into Tony Hickling. Did someone else told you what he had to say?
I've heard of he's come up in a few interviews.
But I don't, well, he's got a place of honor at UBC. It's everyone, you know, he was always looked on as a wise guy who had some kind of connection with UBC and maybe all law schools in the common law world feel some kind of affinity to Lord Denning. But I don't remember what his speech was.
Did you ever, were you ever tempted to become a judge?
Yeah, I about by, maybe 20, 25 years ago, I actually applied. And I wasn't appointed. I heard by the grapevine that I was close, but I never applied again. And I don't think it would have been the right job for me. I probably applied during one of the mini recessions. I think a lot of people think about being a judge when they think of financial insecurity. But you know, right now I know from my work as an arbitrator how tough a job it is being a judge, and to concentrate, remember, make wise decisions is no easy task, and it's probably easier in the earlier part of your career than it would be towards the end of your career.
I saw on the internet that you were involved with the hepatitis C case.
Yeah, that's been a very interesting and rewarding appointment. I was appointed by the court to be fund counsel, which was a new kind of thing for the administration of the settlement. It was $1.2 billion. So fund counsel were appointed in Ontario, Quebec, and BC. And that goes back to about 1999, I think, or 2000, something like that. And it's, for me, it's been interesting, but also it's been an important administration, because what happens is with people who think they're entitled have to go through a couple of hurdles, and they have to show that they had a transfusion between 86 and 90, and they have to show that's likely where they got the hepatitis C, not through an earlier infection or a later infection, not through IV drug use, although they still have a chance. So it's an interesting kind of advocacy, because one of my responsibilities is to defend the decisions of the administrator, and when it goes to an appeal before a referee or an arbitrator. But I've always done whatever I could. Most of these people aren't represented by counsel, but even when they are, I've always done what I could to help them make their case, because if they can make the case they're entitled to, it's not like I'm acting for an insurance company or a defendant that you know, there's a real vested interest in winning. If people can show, so it's been a, you know, I always have good rapport with the people who, whether they succeed or not on their appeals, and that's the way I should be in that position. You know, they can make, now that's winding down. It's very little work now. Not many new claims.
So how did it work? They have to prove they got Hep C during those years, and then there was a fund. You just have to.
Yeah, there was a class action settlement. So the federal government paid the bulk of the settlement into court, I guess, and it was invested wisely. The provincial and territorial governments pay annually their share, if they're called upon to pay annually their share. There'll be a looming battle. Well, there's a looming battle a couple of years from now. It looks like there will be a surplus, and so the feds will want the money returned to them. The claimants will want increased compensation, and other people will probably have some claims on it. But it's too early to pinpoint and designate a surplus at this stage.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a interesting and rewarding appointment.
I was interested earlier in the law school years, 1967 to 70, your feeling that there was an orthodoxy out there that you didn't want to be, you didn't want people telling you that you have to follow this orthodoxy, which is a human and enough response. I feel the same way when in the universities, when certain trends or theories appear, they're kind of flavor of the month. But I've also heard from other people who we've interviewed that they, sort of contemporaries, who've had the same, who felt the same way. And it's interesting how, I mean, what was it exactly that made some people become, you know, radical, hippie, anti-establishment figures, and what was it that made some, you know, others take a more traditional route?
Well, that's a world-changing question, but off the top of my head, I think there's a time to rebel, and I think in the 60s, the radical movement served a useful purpose. For instance, I, having been ex-army, I didn't know, I've said this to an American in a bar in the last couple of years, and it reminds me again, don't talk politics and religion with Americans, but I didn't know it was wrong to be in Vietnam at the beginning. And I learned that as I went, I got more educated. And hats off to the student radical movement for raising awareness and eventually changing the history of the world, I think, by getting out of Vietnam. And so, you know, there's a time for radicalism, but by the time 67 came around, the student radicals were at the height of their power, and I wanted some logic or some reason. Ending the war in Vietnam is something I could understand. Attacking the university administration, you know, you've probably been told about the incident of the pig in the faculty club.
Well, I have,
I just couldn't see the why. It's disrespectful, and some people think of me as a rebel, some people think of me as a conservative, but to me it was I just had the courage to say why in the face of everybody kissing their ass, and to the point where I wanted to make a point about it, and to this day I don't know why. And I'm a good friends with, you know, Carrie and I are friends. Janos Matej used to be John Mate, and his brother Gabor, they're friends of mine, especially Janos. We don't talk about it much anymore, but it was just power going too far, and hats off to the radicals for getting some of the problems of the world changed, but it just went too far, and I couldn't understand why. And I've done a lot of First Nations law in my time, but the pendulum has swung too far that way too, right? And right now, more people should be asking why there should be more power when it doesn't come with responsibility. But these things do go in cycles. I remember as a first year art student, the Cuban Missile Crisis was on, and I don't know how I got into this, but a lot of the view on the campus was U.S. to keep their hands off Cuba. And I remember running around with a spray paint can. I certainly wasn't the leader, I was a follower. Out on the campus one night, putting "keep Russian hands off Cuba," and I don't know where that came from. You know, everything I know about Cuban Missile Crisis now is with hindsight. But you know, students, I just saw Les Miserables the other night, the musical. Students have a role, and part of it is to question and to rebel, and it was fun. It was, you know, the. Sometimes I say, gee, I shouldn't have been in the army. I should have been one of those hippies hanging out. But I wasn't inclined that way, and I thought the military was going to be my career at one time. So I missed out on being a hippie.
You have to admit, though, I don't know if Carrie's told you the story of going up to New Westminster to the pig farm to find a pig. You should ask him, because he...
I think he's probably told the story, and that's probably, and I don't remember it. But you know, it's interesting to see the Chicago Seven or whatever they're called, and the Carrie Lynns 20 years after those days in their three-piece suits and carrying on as a part of the establishment. Some of them, anyway. But should be grateful for, you know, students taking up causes. Just that at that particular time, I just was annoyed at the blind following. The whole world seemed to be kissing their butt.
And if you had worked hard to get there as a young man, you know, you got there through your own effort. Sounds to me like you were pretty determined to succeed at law school. Then I can see why should you throw it all away to rebel? In something that you don't believe in.
No, I don't see it that way. I wasn't tempted to follow. It wasn't self-preservation. I was merely going about living a happy life, whether they made a fuss or not. So I wouldn't be tempted now to invade a faculty club with a pig unless someone gave me a reason to. You know.
Well, it's been interesting interviewing people from the late 60s, because they're Carrie Lynn and Stuart Rush and Mike Harcourt, I think we're all roughly in that era. By comparison, the late 70s there's none of the, I don't get any sense of the same kind of ferment from the later decades.
No, but that you do that apart from the law school too, you know, those days. Were special days. You know, lucky to live through those days, no matter what your political views were. And look what was happening in the American South in those days, and major breakthroughs in human rights and whatnot. Just throwing a bit of politics once more. In 67, I wrote a letter to Pierre Trudeau urging him to seek leadership of the Liberal Party. Because Tom Bridger was a hero of mine, Pierre Trudeau was a hero of mine, and Sergeant Major Lynch from the PPCLI was a hero of mine. I used to say I had three heroes when I was growing up. But I think what I must have been a fan of Pierre's because of his political science teaching on the Constitution when I was a political science student. In any event, he wrote me a letter back saying, you know, it's letters like the one I sent to him that make political life worthwhile. And years later, he and I, just through a coincidence of legal professions, became friends, and I remember telling him about the letter I wrote him. But I mentioned that to show you I've gone through a spectrum of supporting different parties. Like, I've probably supported every real party and voted against every Liberal Party at various stages. Like, you know, when Tom Berger was leader of the NDP, well, there's no way I wasn't behind him. And I'm sure I voted against Trudeau in the odd election, and yet supported him and others. And so I didn't. So I never had a fixed. Well, this is sort of. I decided to run for the House of Commons one time. I didn't know what party to run for. I actually consulted Trudeau. I talked to Tom Berger. I forget who else I talked to, but Pierre said, well, talk to Jean Chrétien. And I said, well, can you introduce us? And he said, well, I'm not in favor right now. Anyway, I was in Ottawa on a case or something. And Ian Waddell, who is was an NDP MP, I told him, I said, I'm determined. It was around sometime in the 80s. I think everyone was disinterested in politics then. I would have gone bankrupt if I'd have got elected. Mm-hmm. But I just decided to get on it. Here again, I decided to get on the soapbox. Someone's got to stand up for the country. So I told these people I didn't know whether to run for NDP, Conservative, Liberal. That's how flaky I am. So I told Ian at lunch in the Parliament Buildings. I only knew Ian casually too, but it's amazing how little contact your representatives in Ottawa have with people from BC, and they always appreciate it if you get in touch with them, and I was never shy about that. John Fraser, the speaker, was one of my mentors, and I became a good, and was always a good friend of mine too. But Ian said, oh, you're having trouble tracking down Chrétien. He says, follow me. And I followed him, and he tracked him down in the hallway, and finally I got to check out Chrétien. So I ended up seeking the nomination for the federal in West Van, but I'd lost interest by the time, and the fix was in to get the party president in there anyway, and I recruited a bunch of people, but you know, my romantic goal sort of just fizzled out, and I forget why I brought that up. But
well, it sounds like you're a pragmatist, not a dogmatist in politics,
or a free thinker anyway. Or I was more so. More of the Don Quixote when I was younger.
Yeah. I could also ask about your siblings. Are they still on the island? Or?
My older sister's been married a couple times, and she lives near Duncan. And my younger sister, she lives in Courtney. I've got some other siblings that my dad fathered. I've got two sisters named Joan.
Well, that's it.
It's like Daryl. And
sounds like a Johnny Cash song.
My dad named my oldest sister Joan, who remembers him, but then he moved on and had three more children, and his first daughter in that relationship was called Joan too. I had a lot of extended cousins and whatnot, and in Cumberland when I was a kid, in Bevan and Embrade, the whole town was like family, you know. I'm not saying that quite the right way, but you know, as far as going fishing or whatever, you didn't necessarily have to do it with your father or your siblings, you did it with your cousins or your neighbors. And you know, with hindsight, quite a comfort zone to have. I guess that's the way it is, or hopefully it's still the way it is in small towns.
Well, the only other question I could ask is, well, before I do that, I was going to ask about your mom, who sounds like I like that piece of advice about what was it?
Don't go logging. Oh no! If you don't ask, you don't get.
Yeah, Yeah, that was
Yeah.
that's a good thing to go into the
Oh,
war
it,
with.
that's, you know, and maybe that's what, I don't know where I got my confidence from, but I just don't know where. Maybe from advice like that.
Well, it would be cumulative if you, once you've started asking questions and seeing that you get a good response,
Yeah.
it would become habit, I suppose.
I think a side of that too is I think I've always been thought of as a very inquisitive, even when I was a little kid. You probably ask questions to the point of, then maybe that's why I've been a successful lawyer. I ask a lot of questions. And I'm very friendly in the sense of in ease and talking to strangers and stuff like that. I used to say about my mother, she insisted she never talked to anybody, but if she was on a bus ride, by the end of the ride, she'd know the history of everybody on the bus. A little joke for you, she used to tell me, what was her advice to me? Don't go logging, and don't date married women. I don't know where that one came from, but I've made many a joke about that since. Oh, and the other advice she gave me, and I asked her a question when I was small once. What do I do when I grow up? And she said, without any malice or without any intention to lead me astray, said, "Well, you go to school till you're 16, and then you get a job and you pay your room and board." You see, that's the expectations. And that's probably most of the people in the town I grew up in, that's probably the expectations they had for their sons too. My older cousin became a teacher, and other people in Cumberland became teachers, and Johnny Wilson, who was a year older than me, became an accountant, but I don't know of others that went on to university.
In my logging work, I interviewed Jack Hodgins, and that was essentially his background. Go to school till you're 16, get a job, pay room and board.
Yeah.
And he had teachers who were recognized. Well, he was smart, and he was naturally curious, and teachers who encouraged him. Did you have? Are there any teachers along the way?
Yeah, they did well. I was born on December 20th, so you probably know the problems that some December boys have in school.
I'm one of them.
So I, in grade 3 or 4, I don't know which one it was, they discovered I'm in a two-room school in Bevan, and they discovered I couldn't read, I was just memorizing. So they put me back to grade 1, on the grade 1 Dick and Jane, I guess. So I was put back a year, but in a way I wasn't, because it would be the same if my mother had kept me till out of school till January, and then I would have had the advantage of being, so I was still, you know, I could have graduated a year earlier, I guess, or maybe I never would have graduated. And my cousin John, who's only about 10 years older than me, he was one of my teachers in that little two-room school. But there was a teacher named Mrs. McElduff in around grade 4 or 5 that I think was a pretty good influence on me. And then there was Mrs. Bryant in grade 7, or in high school anyway, she was a junior, senior. She was quite an influence on me. And I just got better in school from grade 5 onward. In grade 7, there were 2 grade 7s, A and B.
Mm-hmm.
And I made it into A. Don't know if I showed any pride at the time, but that meant you were brighter than the kids in B. So I'm sure I was pretty happy with that. And then I was pampered a bit in high school because I got into student politics in a small school, and I thought I didn't have to do the reading assignments and whatnot. So I wasn't well read by the time I went to university. But in first year arts, I was in this boarding house with five or six other guys, and they were in various years and taking various courses. And I just had an insatiable appetite to read their novels. I'd read whether they're translations from their French class or whatever. And I would read, so I was learning things in first university that I should have learned in high school. But it was eye opening and it was fun. And I remember finishing and passing first year and saying to myself, they can't take that away from you. You've completed 1 year of university. If you never do anything more in your life, you've completed 1 year of university. So I was pretty, I think proud is the right word. I was pleased. I was pleased to do well. That, you know, because it was interesting and novel, but you know, it was destined to be a coal miner or a logger. I don't know why I got interested in education.
There was a guy in Comox, I don't know if you remember him, named Dusty Dastaire.
No.
Who lived down by the pier, who was he had been an officer in the Royal Navy, and he was privately wealthy. And he supported local boys from Comox and Courtney, this is perhaps a bit before your time, to go to university, and he funded them. He didn't want them to go into the woods, so he would find out who the bright boys were, and promote them.
Good for him.
They were known as Dusty's boys.
Mm.
And there's one became an ambassador, one became a Rhodes Scholar, and these were boys he kind of plucked out and said, nope, you don't want to go up to Comox Lake.
Yeah,
don't go to Solon. Don't, you know, they had worked in the summers probably, because you could get work when you were 14 or 15. But that's, but yeah, escaping from the Comox Valley was not, at that time when there was still old growth, there were still forests and there was work. And the logging frontier, as you know, was moving up the island. So you could go up to Wasp Camp or up to Nimkish and still get work in the woods.
Yeah.
So it's,
Yeah, there was money to be made logging. You know, let me tell you something else about 67 to 70, which won't loom large, but what happened in the early 60s is that birth control became available. So in addition to everything else that was going on, there was a sexual revolution going on. And that went on right up till AIDS became common, I guess. So I don't know where that fits in, but by the time law school came around, you know, the risk of pregnancy wasn't there the way it had been before. So just passing that on to a historian, that that's probably a factor in developments of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a major thing, because it allowed women, it meant women had more latitude, more, they didn't have to get trapped immediately in marriage and childbirth. They could go into the professions.
Well, they could also go into more promiscuity.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Which was happy for everybody.
A double-edged sword.
Yeah.
So where did the number of women, they wouldn't have increased as you went through?
No, there was a period in time afterwards that women started becoming more and more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were a rarity in our class.
Mm-hmm. But I should ask you who else I should talk to. You mentioned a few people earlier.
Well, I think Carrie mentioned you should talk to Ian Maxwell.
Yeah, okay. I don't know that.
I don't know how accessible he is. Ian became a very accomplished matrimonial lawyer. And he's one of these guys that, you know, prided himself on not going to class and just barely getting through, too.
Mm-hmm.
You can't talk to Don Brenner because he died on his age 65. I guess you've talked to Joost Blom, have you?
Yes.
So Joost was a classmate. He wasn't Section 2.
Well, there's two
Nick Blom. Nick Blom.
I talked to Nick.
Yeah, Nick was one of my mentors when I was at Ladner Downs.
I did talk to Joost.
Yeah. I think if Brian Webster or Brian Abraham, Harry Boyle I mentioned to you earlier.
John Fraser, is he still?
Yeah, John. Well, John, my classmate, John?
Yeah, well, you met.
Well, John met Fraser used to be the Speaker of the House of Commons. I don't even know if he went to UBC. But there was a John Fraser at UBC too, I think. John, I don't know if he. 100%. Of course, he's part of me. He's a classmate of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But that's a different John Fraser.
I
see. Okay.
Yeah. No, the John Fraser I mentioned earlier was, a decade older than I was, at least, and he was a progressive conservative member of parliament. Sought the leadership of the party at one time, and then he became Speaker of the House of Commons. And then he became Canada's ambassador on the environment or something like that.
Who were the
Let me grab the photo. I think I have the photo of the class downstairs. Angie White is one of the women in the class, and Diane Fillmore. You could talk to Greg Bowden, who's a Supreme Court judge now. Maybe you've talked to enough people from our year.
Well, it's always good to have to know who's around and who you recommend. I was here just before Christmas in this area. I talked to Alec McQuarrie.
See, Tex Enemark was a classmate, but he's never had anything to do with the class since.
What was the name?
Tex Enemark.
Yeah.
You see him quoted in the paper sometimes. I think he's a mining developer or something like that.
Some good ideas.
Okay.
Well.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. If that's about it.
Yeah, well, I told you a lot of personal stuff.
That's
but that's